It is Saturday, October 3rd, 2015. We're broadcasting from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio 88.9 and KOSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Brian Young. He's a CG artist, iOS developer, and lifelong tinkerer.
Hey, Lyle.
Hi. And also Mr. Miles Elam, a political junkie and software engineer.
Hello.
And last but not least, Ben Teacher. Ben Jaffe, a teacher, traveler, and music geek. Hey, Ben.
Ahoy there.
What was that?
Ahoy there.
Oh, wow, it's like a piratey thing. We have any corrections today? Brian?
Yes, we do have some corrections. So it's been several weeks. What was the show that we did?
August 22nd.
On the August 22nd show, we were talking about a 3D printer that prints glass. And I made a quick little comment that one of our listeners did send in about that I was totally wrong on, and I did not know this.
What was your comment?
My comment was that glass is a liquid. And this is something I had always been told.
Liquid, right?
Yeah, what?
Just a very slow-flowing liquid.
A very slow-flowing liquid.
This is not true. Go
on. First thing when dispelling myths, as soon as you repeat the myth, all of a sudden it's implanted everyone's mind. That's not what we're doing here. But when I was a kid, in my house, which was built in the 60s by my granddad, and my granddad built this house at a time that everything was modern. This was a time when the house was modern. He was using modern heating like electricity. And the glass, I remember looking at the glass. When I looked at it, it was all this ripply, wavy stuff.
Uh-huh.
Because it couldn't possibly be the manufacturing process that caused this, because this was a really modern house for the 60s. But I am completely wrong, and this myth has been debunked over and over over again.
Another thing that people will state will be that if old buildings with old glass, the glass is thicker on the bottom than on the top.
That's actually true.
It is true.
But it's not because the window changed. It's because the manufacturing process would often make one side a little bit bigger, and so they would mount it with the fatter side at the bottom because it was more structurally sound.
There you go.
And occasionally you might run into a building that's mounted upside down, and that is just really difficult to explain. Yeah.
And if you're still not sure that this is actually the case, that if you're wondering if we're lying to you, go to Europe to those really old cathedrals where they have glass that's been there for over a millennia.
Is there glass that's all, that's
and so, you will not see that stained glass will not be
droopy.
Yeah.
So their manufacturing process was actually good enough back then?
Yes.
And in the 60s, in the modern age, we couldn't produce glass that wasn't wavy?
We could. They just didn't for your grandfather's house.
Yeah, my granddad's house must have been cheap.
And if you don't believe that and you need to see it for yourself, get a pane of glass and wait 80 years and see what happens.
Speaking of age, happy birthday, Brian.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. Guys, you know, I'd love to sing you happy birthday, but unfortunately it's copyright and we can't.
He's a jolly good fellow.
That's what they always do on the sitcoms, right?
They always do that on the sitcoms, yeah.
Or they make up the happy birthday song you hear in all of the chain restaurants.
Applebee's happy birthday song.
Right. Happy birthday. Right. That's probably copyrighted.
And these exist
too,
because the lyrics for happy birthday are under copyright. So that's why we can't use it on air.
They were under copyright.
What do you mean?
And they aren't anymore, which is fantastic because, I don't know. I don't think they should have been in the first place.
Well, apparently it was questionable legal precedence in the beginning.
Yeah, and so this is actually a recent ruling. A federal judge in Los Angeles ruled that the claim to the Happy Birthday lyrics by Warner Chappell Musics, and they purchased those from another company a while back, is not the case. And this is a copyright that they've collected a lot of royalties for.
Yes.
$2 million last year they collected.
So now we could technically go ahead and sing happy birthday to Brian if we wanted to.
We could. I'm not a lawyer, but...
Instead, let's go on with geek news. That's cool, though. Right. That's awesome.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's great. Well, let's talk about memory.
About memory?
Yeah, about quartz and memory.
Oh,
what's
yes,
in your mind
you.
Versus what's not in your mind? Sorry about that.
Did you forget what you were going to say?
No, I was just kind of thrown off by which story I was going to be covering. Now, with regard to our phones are now an extension of ourselves. And people wonder, when are we going to become cyborgs? Yeah, if you have a smartphone, you already are. You already have augmented memory. You already have something that is electronically keeping you up to date.
That's right. I don't know any of your phone numbers.
Yeah, giving you an excuse to go back and run back to your third grade math teacher and say, see, I can carry a calculator with me everywhere I go. But they also are finding that, or we also find that the law with regard to those smartphones is not always clear.
Yeah.
And one of those is, let's say that someone has accused you of a crime and they think that there is evidence of that crime on your phone. You saying something, you sending an email to someone about this or that. And if they could just get access to your phone because there's a password on it or a passcode, then they could prove that. So you have to give me that passcode. Well, a federal judge has stated, or a federal court has stated, that no, that would be a violation of the Fifth Amendment to write protection against self-incrimination.
So because the password's in your mind only, and you haven't written it down, you're not giving them a physical thing, you're giving them your knowledge, and therefore that is protected.
Not exactly. They were saying that if there had been business records that were on the device, the Fifth Amendment protection would not have applied.
Oh, interesting.
But because they were looking for personal thoughts, personal insights, communications by that person, that becomes
This is not about the password, really. This is about what's on your phone being personal notes, like a personal journal. So, yes. I mean, couldn't you get access to someone's journal?
Yeah, that was a question I was going to ask, is couldn't you look at their mail and get a letter that someone had written to them or something like that?
On the contrary, if you have a, like say, a safe, and you have just the combination in your head, and they say, but we have... There's something in there that we want. We're not really sure what it is, but I'm sure if we open that safe, we can find out. You're not legally required to give the combination to that safe because they're on a phishing expedition. One of the things, and you're not allowed, you're not required to say, hey, here's something that's going to incriminate me.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And so that has now been extending slowly into the electronic sphere and now actually has been tested. Now, it was tested specifically here for some folks who were accused of insider trading.
Uh-huh. So they wanted business access information, not personal thoughts. I mean, well, it was, the case would be based on information that would be insider trading kind of information.
Yes, but this is based upon their access, not an overall business decision, but their personal behavior, their personal thoughts, their personal strategies.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where their protection comes into play. If it were, in fact, a way to try to get information about your business, like say you were the head of a company,
yeah,
and they were business records and they were things, communications with accounting or something like that, then it's not clear or probably unlikely that you would have that.
This wouldn't
same
apply
protection.
Basically yeah. The same ruling. Cool. Well, thank you very much for that. What court was this? Is this relatively high up? Is it going to be appealed and all that? Or is
this is actually a U.S. district judge.
Okay, cool.
Pennsylvania. So.
Thank you, Miles. Ben, let's talk about some space news, some amazing news, actually, extraterrestrial, I should say, news, just recently. Yeah,
this is outside of our little pale blue dot. This is Mars, and NASA...
The pale red dot?
So NASA made an announcement a couple days ago saying, we have an announcement, and they just made it.
As we're recording this, yes.
Yeah, actually, just this morning, because we're recording on Monday. So they did a press conference, and they shared some findings that they had made based on the images and spectra taken by the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter's high-rise camera. And that shows what are called RSLs, which are recurrent slope lineae. Basically, they're these...
You're not even
going
to try, are you?
They're these lines that run down the sides of craters and canyons. And
yes.
The idea behind it is that these dark streaks along the sides of craters and canyons may be flowing water.
That's been the hypothesis.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And so they've been kind of, you know, talking
focusing
a little bit
yeah.
about this,
yeah.
but they haven't actually made an announcement yet. They made the announcement this morning, Monday morning, September 28th, that indeed they have concluded that there is running water on Mars. Now, this is not necessarily like a lake or something,
right.
or a constantly flowing river, but they're basically saying there is relatively consistently and currently, like within this time frame, within this year, running water on Mars.
Well, within high rises scanning, because they've taken pictures and they've taken pictures again, and it looks like there's kind of what looks to us as waterfalls or sand falls, but they potentially could be water. So now they're basically saying, yeah, everything we've concluded is that it's water. Now, of course, this would be very briny water, because the temperature never really gets hot enough for liquid, I mean, for water that's pure.
Was part of the evidence that they were looking at was not just this, but also the salt content in these particular areas.
So we've got flowing water on Mars, which leads us to think potentially that could be life or more chance.
Right. So for this, for these kinds of stories, I don't hypothesize on my own because I just don't follow it closely enough. Instead, I go to slate.com/blog/badastronomy. That's
Badastronomy.
Phil Plait's amazing blog called Bad Astronomy.
So what does he say?
On the contrary, is some of the best astronomy that is readable to laymans like me. He said, this whole problem set, mystery, whatever, is far from solved. So here are a couple just excerpts from his post on this. Where does the water come from? How much is there? Is it just water, or are there other substances involved? And then later he says, we know Mars has a lot of water ice, and it once had vast amounts of standing and flowing liquid water on its surface in the past. This doesn't change that. This finding doesn't change that. Mars may have once had life, but we still don't know, and we don't know if there's life there now. So it doesn't really change our current understanding of how likely it is that there's life on Mars now. But it does indicate that there is temporary, at least, flowing water.
Awesome. And aside from life, it does mean that water, all on the scale of things, fairly massive, we're mostly made of it, and it's something you have to haul back and forth. The fact that it's already there means that now, that becomes a lot easier.
It's not as, I mean, that aspect's not as exciting to me because, I mean, it is, of course, exciting, but we've known for a while that there's water ice on Mars. So getting there and being able to use the water ice is something I've kind of accepted already that we're able to do. So this, if it's flowing now, means that potentially there's been liquid there for a long time, and therefore microbes and stuff could actually exist in it, which would be kind of cool.
Yeah, it means that instead of heating up ice and melting it to get water, we need to figure out how to desalinate really briny water.
Right.
I'm just trying to figure out, because we have a long history as humans of going to new places and then finding life and finding out that we actually brought the germ or we brought something with us. Right. And I remember when we started doing the missions to Mars that there was some concern, and they tried to disinfect all of the satellites going there. But there was a statement, I remember, that wasn't fully possible. So it seems like we've got to do this science quickly to find out whether this is going to be life from Earth or whether it's actually Martian life.
I think that ship's almost already sailed in some ways, because we've crash-landed on there before. In any case, let's go ahead and talk about some other space news. Anything massive we could talk about?
Well, there's a supermassive...
Yeah, that sounds good.
Super.
...black hole finding. And one of the things I want to think about is the fact that the Andromeda Galaxy and the Milky Way Galaxy will combine sometime in the distant future.
Not something you have to worry about?
Right. In a few billion years. You know, it's coming right for us, very slowly, relative to their size.
The Andromeda Galaxy, of course, is the galaxy closest to ours. Mm-hmm.
And also, when it collides with us, we're not anticipating that it'll mean the end of life or anything. It's like a huge thing with a lot of empty space.
It's like
colliding.
It's like two gas clouds hitting one another.
Right. Collision isn't exactly the right
word. Or like two swarms of gnats.
We will interact with each other.
Now,
gravitationally.
Inside of most galaxies that we've looked at, possibly all galaxies, there is a supermassive black hole.
Yes.
Sagittarius A star, I believe, is the one that's the center of Milky Way. Now, when you have two galaxies come together and merge, that means those two supermassive black holes, things that are billions of solar masses in size, or in mass, will be coming into close proximity to one another. That's why the galaxies are coming close to one another, is because these great concentrations of mass are drawing each other in. What they have, what astronomers have found, are two supermassive black holes spiraling each other at very close distance.
Orbiting each other.
Orbiting.
Yeah.
Spiraling in. Okay. They are getting closer and closer. And because they are so massive and because they are so close, that angular momentum has them going at 7% of c.
Of the speed of light?
Of the speed of light.
Wow.
And you go,
wait, what speed?
7%.
Whoa.
Yeah, right.
Fast. Really fast.
Many of you may be wondering, like, 7%. Like, I want to go 90% of the speed of light to get someplace. Because we talk about if you could go 90% of the speed of light, it would still take you, what, 100 years to get to...
That's not going to happen.
...star or something like that. Well, not quite. But here, it's 7% of... What was it again? 300,000...
7% of the speed of light.
...meters per second squared?
In miles per hour. Is 46,900,000 miles per hour.
That clarifies everything for
right,
us.
Right. That number doesn't make any sense to me.
No.
Right. It's so big that the human brain just can't grasp it anymore. We can grasp 5 miles per hour. We can grasp 50 miles per hour.
I can't grasp 50 miles per hour.
We can kind of grasp 500 miles per hour. I mean, the airplane.
Sure.
Not intuitively, but yeah. Like, with math, well, we can multiply by 10.
We can look at the
10.
Ground, and we can have a relative path. We can, we can still kind of...
It's still not native, but anyway.
But anyway.
Millions.
Fast, fast, fast.
Now, this is not our galaxy. This is not Andromeda galaxy.
Right.
This is another faraway thing.
Right.
Okay, cool.
Very far away, thank goodness.
Hey, you listen to Geek Speak. Stay with us. This is Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm speaking with Brian Young, Ben Jaffe, and Miles Elam. We are talking about super black holes orbiting each other. Ben, do you have anything super to talk about?
I guess so.
You know what? I feel kind of dirty doing that segue, but you did set me up for it. So
I did. I did. The supermoon, the blood supermoon, whatever they were calling it.
The supermoon.
Right. So two things. One, the supermoon is not 3 times the size it normally is.
What? It looked huge on the horizon.
Right. If you come across anything, if you ever come across something being like, the moon will be 3 times or 10 times or whatever, or it'll affect the tides this much, or you should plant your crops at this time.
Then the world is about to end and you should get your affairs in order.
And our understanding of physics is thoroughly broken.
So, in which case, start praying.
Now that all of that is out, and actually I'll link on geekspeak.org to a blog post by... none other than the bad astronomer, Phil Plait. And he says that the largest difference between the size of the moon when it's furthest away from Earth and closest to Earth is less than 14% of its size. The blog post title is called The Supermoon Stuff Again. And this blog post was posted on May 2nd, 2012. So this supermoon thing comes and goes.
It's like it happens annually or something. It's amazing.
Everyone's always talking about it.
I don't watch TV. Are they literally saying that on news reports?
I mean, I don't know. I'm sure on some news reports because our science reporting is pretty abysmal here.
You said
you'll see it on blog posts and things like that.
Yeah. You said two things.
Facebook.
What's the second thing? One, it's not as big as you think it is. And
the second thing is I tried to look for... Oh, and the reason that it's the blood supermoon is that it was lunar eclipse, which means that the Earth passed for a very short period of time in between the sun and the moon. And the reason that the moon turned red is because the light from the sun that was getting to the moon was actually refracting through the Earth's atmosphere.
Wait, was it an eclipse at all? I mean, did it enter our shadow?
Yes.
Yeah, it did.
So completely or partially? Did anybody see it?
No, no, it was completely. I went up there last night.
Complete? Oh, cool. I love that. That looks
really really pretty. And I can't tell you that from experience because it was really cloudy I was.
But Brian, you saw it?
Yeah. The moon came out from behind the clouds with about 3 minutes left before the sunlight hit it again.
So happy birthday to you, right?
Yeah, exactly. Awesome. It was all for my birthday.
Okay, one other thing. You alluded that it was on the horizon, therefore it's a different size. And I want to blow your mind on something. The moon does not change size when it's on the horizon.
So there's no gravitational lensing going on?
No.
and minimal atmospheric lensing of any kind. The reason why it looks so big is because of your brain, not because of what's actually happening.
It's really hard to believe this.
I do not believe it, but I know it's true.
Uh-huh, right. So you logically believe it.
So I've seen pictures where people take a picture of it, at the horizon, a picture, and... then later you look at it exactly the same size the entire time.
But you know how to actually trick your brain into seeing it the right way, don't you?
No, how?
You got to hold out your fist so you've got something to compare to.
Yeah.
And the reason why your brain gets confused is it doesn't have anything to compare to once it gets too high.
Yeah.
Or it's
so
comparing it to
what
the
you
want
to do is when the moon's like in a full moon around sunset or a little bit after that, if you will, depending on where it is, you're going to see the moon. And because a full moon is opposite the planet of the sun.
So when the sun goes down, the moon goes up.
That's right. Or vice versa.
Or if you want to have it proved that it is fairly small from your perspective in the sky, take a photo of it with your smartphone.
Yeah,
you'll see
true.
Exactly how small it can be. Right.
So anyway, what you can do is just put your hand out when it's at the horizon and put your thumb next to the moon with the right distance and just kind of take a look at the comparison size. And then at midnight, when it's above us, put it up again and you'll see that it's the same size as your thumb. I mean, comparatively the same size as it was before.
Phil Plait's final point in his article is... Even though it's not super, the moon isn't exactly mild-mannered either. So if you can, just go out and look. Not just this weekend, but anytime. Because it's pretty, and it's ours, and it's always worth a look. And I agree with him.
Aw, he's like so, poetic and everything.
It's so sweet.
Ben's got a geek crush, I can tell.
I totally have a geek crush on Phil Plait. If you're listening, Phil Plait, come on our show. You're probably not listening.
All right, let's talk about network speeds now. Brian?
Yeah, so it is great. We have great internet in our country, right?
No. That's what I hear. We don't.
No, actually, so let's see. How long has it been since LTE came to cell phones?
I would say 3 years.
It's been a little over 3.5 years. Actually, no, closer to 4 years.
Okay.
And the problem is that if you happen to be on the cutting edge, putting in the technology first, you get the first version of that technology. And unfortunately, the U.S. Is showing its age in LTE speeds and performance.
What does LTE stand for?
Oh, you got me.
As we all start searching.
Type.
Go on, Brian.
Long-term evolution.
So long-term evolution.
Yeah. Long-term evolution.
Which, I don't know. It's kind of like calling it Art Nouveau. It's going to be old vo soon.
No.
So it's not on the edge anymore. It's long-term evolution.
It means that the plan forward is to keep evolving, so you don't have a version frozen in time, I'm assuming.
And that's very apropos.
Kind of like Chrome browsers and things of that nature. Go on.
It's very apropos because a great many countries now have... deployed LTE throughout their cell phone systems, and they are getting much, much better speeds than we're getting here in the country because they're using a more recent version of the technology with new protocols and technologies added to it. So here in the U.S., where we have a system that's getting close to 4 years old, we have dropped to 55 in ranked performance around the world.
Wow. Oh, man.
So you're saying we rushed to get that 14.4 modem, and now the 56Ks are out.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's just like buying a computer right when it comes out, and now that we're getting a little older and the new one's going to come out, we're feeling kind of slow.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not all bad news. There's different metrics, and this all comes from... Open Signal. Have you used it on your phone? It's a app that you can...
Oh, yeah. We covered this maybe a couple years ago or something.
So it's a crowdsourced way to measure cell phone systems around the world. They have 300,000 people that have been contributing to it recently. And that's where all this data comes from. And out of those 300,000 people, it shows that while we be maybe 55th in performance, we have our... at a 78% what they call time coverage. Now, this gets a little hard to explain.
The amount of time that you're with your phone, how much it has good coverage?
You've seen the coverage maps across the United States for the different cell phone companies.
Yes, because commercials are everywhere and they lie about. Yeah.
So that metric is useful as far as it goes, but if most people spend most of their time where that map is actually colored in, they're going to get more time on the network. And as you go and look at these other systems put across the world, they have... greater speeds, but their coverage is low enough that the percent of time that you can expect to be on the system is a lot less.
Oh, interesting.
So
we have better coverage, but not as good performance.
Yeah. This report was put out this last Wednesday, and that they've got a really important, really interesting graph showing where all the countries fall on the spectrum between how much time they get to use it and how fast their performance is.
You know, and anything you want to read up on that we talk about on GeekSpeak, you're welcome to join us online. You just go to geekspeak.org and all the stories we have links to and the full articles and all that. So you're welcome to do that. Of course, you can email us if you'd like, geeks@geekspeak.org. We do read all of your email. We sometimes and almost always respond. At least one of us will, not necessarily the one that knows what they're talking about. Additionally, you can talk with us online on Facebook and Twitter and things of that nature. Let's talk a little bit about learning to code. We talk about this a lot. I realized earlier when we were prepping for the show, we're all eating together, that all of us are programmers, the four of us are programmers, which means that we have a very strong opinion about coding and how important it is. But what does the general public think about coding? And I think Ben, you've got a story about this?
Oh, yeah. There's a story about this. It was actually a blog article an opinion piece that Jeff Atwood put out. Anybody know Jeff Atwood? Stack Overflow. He started Overflow. He also is the guy behind Discourse, one of the couple guys behind Discourse, which is a open source. It's an open source discussion forum.
Stack,
cool guy.
And Stack Overview is a place to Stack Overflow is a place where when you're a programmer, you can look up and post comments about code problems and get responses and participate in kind of the social structure of helping each other out.
Yeah. Well, more importantly, they have a way of hopefully the best answer rising to the top.
Yes.
Right. And most problems that you search for, the top result is a Stack Overflow post about the problem that you're
trying to deal with.
If the problem is about programming. That's a good thing. So this guy totally knows his stuff, right? His opinion piece, though, I kind of disagree with. And his point is when he was learning to code, in order to be a computer user, you had to be a computer programmer. Because it was the 80s or it was the early
70s,
90s,
yeah.
Right? The
70s. Maybe.
He said he started in the early 1980s as a teenager.
Okay.
And at that time, you did kind of have to be programming the computer in order to use the computer. His point is that these days, we don't necessarily need to teach everybody computer science in schools, particularly if it comes at the expense of other fundamental skills like reading and writing and mathematics. Mm. And on the one hand, I don't imagine that teaching CS would have to come at the expense of some other skills. At the same time, you could say that about music, you could say that about art, and eventually you just have some number of hours in the day, right? And you can't keep the kids in for more hours. So
yeah.
How do you balance that?
So if we talk about an analogy, we don't necessarily want all people to know how a car actually works and how to make a car.
Yeah, exactly the analogy he brings up.
But we all want people to be able to use a car. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
But at the same time, I don't necessarily want everyone to grow up to become a scientist, but I do want everyone to be exposed to science.
That is a big difference in my opinion. That's exactly where I would go with that too, Miles. Mm-hmm. I agree with you. Do you want to elaborate on what you mean by that with regards to programming?
Well, I do think that with regard to programming, I think that programming is awesome because it has a feedback loop, that it is not just logic and mathematics, but it's also that feedback comes back where you've input that program. You've learned how to turn something into a series of discrete steps and algorithm to say, I need to get from point A to point B. What are the steps I need to do? And then you're getting back the result that is more than just the teacher saying, yeah, you got that problem right.
Right.
It is in fact red on the screen. Oh, it is in fact moving across. Oh, it is, is that feedback that I think is so helpful to a lot of people to try to move a little bit further, the practical angle to it.
So you're advocating that you can learn to think better because you've got a tool that's actually giving you feedback on whether you're coming up with the correct answer, because it either works or it doesn't work.
Yes, but only with regard to the basics of programming. I don't think that people need to learn to the extent that, for example, we have. I don't think that's necessary to be a well-rounded human being. I don't think that it's necessary to even learn data structures like linked lists or stacks and the like. It's that basic knowledge of shuffling variables around and being able to have basic interaction through a series of steps. That's what I think to be that first step being so important.
I want to use some thoughts on this area from my friend Warren Sack, who's a professor at UCSC in computer science and art. And his feeling, and I definitely believe it, I'll paraphrase him because I understand this to be my own feeling as well, and that is that the reason why programming is so essential to learn is not to be a programmer, but because our society is so codified. And if you don't understand how computer systems work and you live in a world that's completely controlled by computer systems, you aren't part – you have a weaker ability to be a citizen of that world. And so an example of this is everything we do now, whether we apply to school or get our grades in school, get our driver's license, buy a house, get a mortgage, deal with our bank – all of that is codified into programming languages. And the people that actually write that code and modify the system that actually controls your life have a knowledge above and beyond what you can do. And that's an elitism to some degree. And you need to counter that, because if the society at large is always following those rule sets that are codified, they can't participate at the same level.
Well, can I rephrase something you're saying in a way that I think might help? So when we're talking about science, we've been very clear that we want our society to have a better literacy in science, mm-hmm. so that we can make decisions as a society in government that make more sense, that work better. But when it comes to computers, if our society understands computers better, if they understand the inner workings of the computer, maybe we would apply where computers are effective and where they're not as effective better.
Yeah, so one additional thing that he says in here, and actually it's funny you brought up the example of cars, is he says, by teaching low-level coding, I worry that we're effectively teaching our children the art of automobile repair, when really everybody just needs to know how to drive cars, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that he has a point there, in that if we're teaching them just the basics of programming, but we're not teaching them the big picture, if you will, like anyone can, you know, type what the teacher wrote up on the whiteboard and then compile it and see it run, right? But you're no closer to understanding what's actually going on in the computer and how it affects your life because you did that. So I guess the question that I would pose, and we can also talk about how you disagree, but the question that I would pose is, how can computer science education for K-12 go about teaching the big picture without teaching, you know, kids the computer equivalent of how fuel injection works when it's not necessarily relevant?
But that feels to me like you are talking about a general issue with teaching. For example, mm-hmm. if you were teaching history, you can teach your kids, all right, memorize these dates. So when I say Civil War, you say 1861 to 1865.
That's what happened to me, yeah.
All right, but that doesn't tell you the greater picture of what was going on with regard to it. And mm-hmm. it takes away a lot of the blood of it.
Well, I think that's really interesting because I've tried to teach my parents computers over the years. And one of the things I learned was that my parents literally learned by rote. And when I sat down and tried to teach them the way that I found was effective in school, the things that I learned in school, I learned because I actually started to see how to apply it in many different ways. I tried to do that to my dad and he just literally could not get it. So mm-hmm. I was wondering, when you guys are learning at your best, are you learning facts? Are you learning the connections between everything better?
It's the connections between, and that's specifically why I did so poorly at history and I did so well at computer science.
Yeah. And I think I want to sum a few of these things up before we take a break. And that is that I agree, Brian and Miles, the idea that it's about how we teach it. And I think that the empowerment is not necessarily to be able to understand exactly how the software works that controls the voting systems, but to be able to understand that when you want to make decisions around technology and around computer science, I mean, if you want to make decisions about affecting the world intelligently, you have to understand at some level what's happening in computer science. And that's maybe very hard to describe, but one way is that this is this wonderful idea of what's happening with encryption and backdoors in Congress. When you understand computer science well enough, and then you hear politicians say, well, just make a backdoor so you can get in the inside of the back end, you know, and it'd be safe. Mm-hmm. You understand that that's actually not really possible. Mm-hmm. And to have that discussion, you need to have a level of knowledge about computer science that's above what most people have. And therefore, we're talking about pretty intense debate that most people can't participate in. That's not a society that functions well. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to take a break. Maybe we'll continue back this conversation. Do stay with us. This is Geek Speak here on KWSB. In the air with me is Brian Young, Miles Elam, and Ben Jaffe. I'm Lyle Troxell. You're listening to Geek Speak. More information about our discussions, of course, is up at geekspeak.org. Who is this author?
This is Jeff Atwood, and he's fairly well known in programming circles. And also, I should say that if you're enjoying this discussion, take the time, if you can, to go and actually read his specific article, because I don't want to be accused of, you know, like, of, I guess,
setting up a straw man.
Yeah, exactly. Setting up a straw man. Like, he does actually make some good points. I think it's a little bit too firmly written, and I'm not exactly sure how to put it.
Well, does he
cover
the issue of learning and teaching computer science and understanding at a general level? I mean, that's the thing that I think all of us are kind of talking about, this nuanced, is that we're not saying that everybody should learn to be able to do a Hello World program. Like, that will help society.
Yeah.
But it's more that because our society is kind of engaged with computers, some familiarity with the discussion makes sense.
Yeah, his final paragraph is, we shouldn't be teaching children computer science. Instead, we should provide them plenty of structured opportunities to play with hardware and software. There's a whole world waiting to be unlocked.
Okay, so he's saying, yeah, of course.
He's kind of saying a similar thing to what we're saying. He's just, you know, taking a slightly different angle at getting there, I guess.
Yeah, I will say, and I think that others in this room may agree with me, is that when I first took programming, back when it was really a struggle for me to get any lines of code out, and you worked all night just to get 100 lines done, my impression and my interaction with computers changed dramatically after that. It was night and day. For me, interacting with computers after I did that first course, not going on to
not to become education, a professional become a expert career, you are now, no. Yeah.
Just that one course enabled me to interact with a computer so much better, more powerful.
Can you give an example?
I remember one thing that came to mind was, as I said, learning the steps, learning the algorithm, learning to say, okay, I got to do this, then I got to move this over here, then I got to do that, changed the way that I interacted with programs when I went to, at the time with Windows, you know, the file menu, and then save, and then go to the directory that I need to go to. And
Can I make an assumption that it did something where you went, oh, wait, I had to figure out this how this would work and codify that, and then now I'm using something else somebody else made, and therefore I'm kind of figuring out what they did to make it work the way that's worked.
You started to see the machine.
Way of saying what I said.
Well, I wouldn't say he started to see the machine. He started to see the human being on the other side of the machine, right? He started seeing there was another programmer there, and she had done certain things, and that's why he was experiencing what the world he was experiencing.
Yeah. How do you solve that problem? How would I solve that problem if I were in the other person's shoes?
That's really interesting.
So you're not taking it from the point of view of, well, I don't know, is it totally obvious to me?
What I found interesting in current day programs, something like Facebook, which is extremely complicated, there's so many developers, you know, there's like 150 developers working on the iOS app at Facebook, right? And that app has a whole bunch of test cells and changes all the time that I now feel relatively lost most of the time because that translation I normally do with programming software, mm-hmm. I understand it changes so much, it's hard for me to keep up with that personalization or that humanization of it.
You're not going to see the thought process because there's too many thoughts behind it?
And there's too many algorithms behind it. There's not human beings really deciding what I see. You know, it's kind of there's a complexity level there that we hadn't seen before in software, I think.
Miles, I want to go back to what you were saying. I had a similar experience when I was a teenager, and I took a summer camp, and I learned to write some C++. And
like you do.
Like you do, right?
Nerd.
After that experience, I have to say, I did not particularly enjoy writing C++, but...
No one particularly enjoys writing
thanks.
C++.
Hey, back up, buddy.
But after that experience, my mindset changed. I went from, there's this computer, I know people can program it, to there's this computer, if I want to, I can program it.
Yeah.
And that mindset change is exactly what educators, I think, should be ideally after.
Yeah.
I work at Udacity teaching computer science. I teach front-end web development. And whenever I'm building a course, I'm after not that they learn what document.getElementById means, but that those paradigm shifts of, oh, I can make an offline app now, or, oh, this is within my purview. I can figure this out on my own just by doing a little bit of Googling. That's the important part in education. It's not so much learning what a for loop is. It's learning that you can do things multiple times.
Yeah. And so this is not just sorry to interrupt. But, this is something that isn't just limited to computer science. Like this is a large area where I think that people over-specialize way too early, and they should get exposure to a wider variety of things.
You're arguing for liberal arts education, sir.
Yes. I think people should end very specifically in art and in music. And yes, I have a literature background as well and history, that there should be a smattering of all those because Lord knows there are enough people writing manuals and writing code that don't know how to write a complete sentence correctly. But
the pedant speaking.
Yeah. And you have entire channels dedicated to history that don't teach much history.
So true.
That's a shame.
Okay, let's wrap this up with Brian. Did you have anything else to close out with?
No.
All right. So I want to go ahead and tackle actually an issue that has a lot of technology behind it that affects our world. And the car industry is a perfect example of this. We had this whole discussion last week about how Volkswagen has been hiding information about how their cars actually perform. And I think that's been covered really, really well. But in general, just to sum up, they had their cars do certain things so that their emissions were really low when they were being tested, and then when they're out on the street, their emissions are really bad.
But so they manipulated the testing.
They totally manipulated the testing. Oof. It's really bad news. So, Miles, you've got a story about this to take it even a deeper, more technical step and talk about the Digital Millennium Copyright
Act. And other organizations, Consumer Reports, when they're testing cars, or mm-hmm. Car and Driver, they are testing, like, hey, if I send this car toward a brick wall, how is it going to react? Is the airbag going to deploy correctly?
How's it going to react? I know what'll happen.
me too.
if you send it down a wet road, how well is it going to be able to keep its handling? Mm-hmm. Are those tires going to wick as much water out of the way with the treads as you'd like uh-huh. to get better traction? And so you're able to test all of these aspects. You're able to test, hey, will this actually hold the cup in my cup holder? But there's a boundary point between that internal combustion engine where you can say, like, this has this many cylinders and this has this much capacity and the...
We put this many liters of gas in it, this is how far it drove,
exactly.
That kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And to the computer processors that are in that car... That control,
control
how much gas is going in there and how fast I'm doing the pulse to make the brakes more effective.
What do you mean there's a boundary between them?
There's a boundary because once you hit that boundary of the algorithm,
the software,
the software, you can't test it anymore. You have no idea. Largely because of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. You cannot say, hey, show me your source code so that I can see what you were doing.
And in fact, in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act has a section there saying that if you try to get past something that was meant to be in place to dissuade you from getting past it, you are breaking the act. Yes. It's illegal. And therefore, even trying to figure out how the system works at some level is actually something that's illegal.
So researchers will want to look in there and see, like, okay, if this particular scenario happens, or
so what
I
you're
want to
saying
be able to see how this will react.
What and you're saying is just like you could test the car on a road, you can't actually get into the guts of how the machine thinks without breaking this law.
Right.
And therefore,
whereas you can do just about anything else. You can replace the shocks and see what's the difference going to be. You can replace the wheels and see the diameter change and go, this is how the ride, how the handling changes, or mm-hmm. the comfort of the ride.
So the DMCA is that gap between the hardware that you can replace and test versus the software that you're not even legally allowed to try to figure out.
Right. So do you think the output of this giant flaw in our system is going to be some rules and regulations about open sourcing software? Because
in the auto industry?
Yeah.
No. You mean requiring it?
Well, wouldn't that be amazing? Just say, you know what? We can't trust you, so always have to give us what your code looks like.
I'm pessimistic in that regard. But this comes into play with regard to the VW boondoggle that's been going on right now, where researchers or people who are testing it were seeing, like, hey, I'm seeing this great mileage, or I'm seeing these great emissions lowering. But you can't – it took a lot of effort for them to put in something that can read from the tailpipe without blocking the tailpipe, because you block the tailpipe, then suddenly the car doesn't run so well.
The probe is actually less diameter than the tailpipe, but right. I get your point. You'd have to bypass what they were doing. You'd have to actually drive the car on the road with the full testing gear with you. Of course, these things are not portable.
And then once you saw the discrepancy, to go, what is causing this?
Right.
If it's a physical thing, you can look and see what's the component in there. If it's software – you are stuck for years. I mean, this investigation had been going on for years of a back and forth until VW finally came out and said, yes, we wrote some code that falsified the results
exactly
when you're doing a smog test.
This
is also true of when you have Jeep, for example, getting a remote exploit and being able to control the car. That
again, we weren't able to find that very easily because we didn't have access legally to look into the systems that they have got in place. Right? It would have been possible potentially to look at the source code they wrote and go, hey, there's a problem here. But because it's hidden, closed box, mm-hmm. and then the DMCA wrapped around it to protect it, it's really difficult to find out how safe these things are. And we're seeing a lot of flaws in this kind of things because of the software complexity mm-hmm. and because of this hidden feature of a legislation around it. I hope that it gets fixed and resolved. I can't imagine that we keep going this direction. This is really a wonderful story, though, in relating to talking about general computer science knowledge in society, because this discussion is kind of it's and we're not even doing a really great job of it because we're not legislators, but it's hard to imagine people doing a great job without computer science background in this area. Mm-hmm. I mean, the DMCA exists, for example, and it was probably a bad law.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and what was the rationale for the DMCA to keep the stuff locked up so that their trade secrets in making the code wouldn't get out there?
Well, was the DMCA to begin with was just bringing the copyright law into the digital age, because there really weren't any laws dealing with that, with regard to the fact that you can make a make millions of copies of something
for free,
with very little effort, and disseminate them over wide areas. That just wasn't covered in existing copyright law.
And so in order to enforce that copyright law, they needed some way to lock it down, like a DVD couldn't be copied unless they figured out the encryption key. And the DMCA was there to say, hey, you can't look into this to find out the encryption key, because that would break this law.
That, I think, was actually a fundamental misunderstanding of technology by lawmakers, to say that even if something was an obviously flawed implementation, you're still not allowed to go in and take a look and publish those results about it being a problem. I see the intent. The intent, I think, was honest.
So the argument I hear against copyright, which applies to the DMCA, is that copyright's there so that people can earn a good amount of money for all the research they put into producing something. They need to get a just reward back so that our society furthers its knowledge and has a motivation to further knowledge. Whereas if things were simply just stolen immediately and used and anybody could make money off of a discovery, that our society would shut down and stop producing knowledge in this way. But in the digital age, I don't see any sign of this happening.
Okay, so we have some great shows about copyright on GeekSpeak, and one of the things that I learned early on in discussing this topic is that you don't always the other reason to put price on value on something that's copyrightable, putting that on there, is to give value to everything that's creative. So if you say this painting has a value of this much and you can't copy it, then the person either wants to use it by spending the money to pay for it, or they invest money somewhere else to get it. It elevates creativity. Value. So that's another system. But we won't get in. Let's move on from copyright. Do you want to close up that story, Miles?
Yeah, which is just when we're talking about VW in that particular case, a sport wagon, because it was on my short list for cars earlier.
Oh, no.
Where it was getting 42 miles a gallon, you know, of diesel. That's awesome. And it was still able to get good emissions. Well, just to put in perspective, there's a new data set that says that air pollution kills 10 million people per year.
Oh, that's a lot.
And that's a lot of that is going to be like cooking and burning fires, like for
But the gas mileage was like so that. Good.
Right, exactly. That when some people were saying like, well, why is the government even getting involved in there? Who cares? I want to get my good gas mileage. It really does make an impact on human life.
Not to mention climate control.
Yes.
I want to mention something. We GeekSpeak started in Santa Cruz. It's a Santa Cruz organization, at least it is right now. Who knows how the future will be. But we are geeks in Santa Cruz, right? So I want to do a throw out to some people that are geeks in Santa Cruz. Crafted in Santa Cruz is a Kickstarter campaign that's happening right now. It's basically an apparel company that's focusing and glorifying some creative processes that are happening in Santa Cruz, which is cool. And some people that I know that do creativity in Santa Cruz are actually in their Kickstarter video campaign, which is kind of fun. Beer and music and food and all that. And you can find link to that program, that little video, up at geekspeak.org. Ben, you got a short thing about a rubber ducky?
I've got a shirt and a short thing about a rubber ducky. Yeah, this is actually another space story. This is Europe's Rosetta spacecraft. Pop quiz, anyone know where it is right now?
The solar system?
Yeah, it's in the solar system. Good job, Lyle. You win 100 points. Yeah, it's hanging out next to a particular comet, which it's studying. And this comet looks kind of like a rubber duck. And like, it kind of is a really important word.
This is a Rorschach test.
It looks like a rubber duck as much as two lumps of rock can look like a rubber duck. Now, why does it look like a rubber duck? Well, normally you would imagine a comet would be kind of a spheroid. It would be round. But it turns out that it's not. And there were two theories. One is that two comets came together and kind of came together and stuck together and fused together. a long time ago. And then the other one is that there was some kind of outgassing somehow, which bubbled up the rock in a weird way.
Awesome. If you want to see pictures of this, you can go to geekspeak.org. Geekspeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And Geekspeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast of California, 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz, live online at kosp.org. To find out more about anything, geekspeak.org. Our theme is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Lyle Troxa with Ben Jaffe, Brian Young, and Miles Elam. And this is the October 3rd episode of Geekspeak. Ben, you want to have one more thought?
Oh, yeah. It turns out that it's actually two pieces of rock, not a weird outgassing thing.
Oh, they figured it out.
That's what they figured out.
Two independent comets that merge. Yeah.
It's duck head and duck body kind of stuck together.
They probably bounced off each other a couple times and then merged together.
They were in love and they came together long ago.
It's a long time ago.
A celestial love story.
Brian, did you want to cover in 20 seconds
your heavenly relationship?
Your quick story?
Okay, this is a great web extra. If you want to go to geekspeak.org, you can learn how the graphics were done on the old computers. How can you make multiple colors in just 16K of RAM?
Ooh, cool.
Yeah, it explains it really well. It's really fun, especially for anybody getting into computer science.
And thanks to Greg and Chandler for making the show. They are behind the scenes making the show happen. Thanks for listening to Geekspeak, and we'll see you next week.